You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
After John Corzine left the New Jersey governor's office in 2010, he returned to his previous career in finance when he became the CEO of the brokerage firm MF Global. Since then, the firm has taken huge losses and declared bankruptcy, and $1.2 billion of client funds has turned up missing. Three Vanity Fair business writers, Brian Burrow, William D. Cohn, and Bethany McLean, join us now to discuss the professional and personal tribulations of John Corzine's career in finance and in politics, and whether this is a scandal he can survive. Their article, John Corzine's Riskiest Business, is in the February issue of Vanity Fair, and talk about timing, the paperback edition of William Cohn's latest book, Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, which is published by Anchor Books, is being released today. And I'm very pleased to welcome you all to our show.
Thank you.
So, Bill, let's begin with you. Most people know John Corzine as the former governor of New Jersey who lost his reelection bid to Chris Christie in 2009. But what was his background on Wall Street before he got into politics?
Leonard, he was a trader. He'd been on the government bond desk at Goldman Sachs and slowly but surely worked his way up the ladder at Goldman Sachs, really making one risky bet after another, some of which paid off, some of which didn't. But interestingly, whether they paid off or not, he seemed to get rewarded. Either he got rewarded for his pluck, for sort of getting them out of a bad situation, or when he became the senior partner of the firm, he got rewarded, even though the firm was having a terrible year, for, you know, just sort of being the guy who could defuse the bombs that he had created. So he got reinforced often at Goldman in his some bad behavior.
Well, you have to wonder about the psychological impact of that kind of rewarding. He had started up poor, and suddenly must have felt like he had,
hit the jackpot. He's from a rural downstate Illinois. His grandfather had been a relatively wealthy man, but lost it all in the Depression, and his father was basically a sharecropper on his aunt's land. And then, of course, he grew up relatively poor, jobs going through high school. He was a quarterback on the football team and the captain of the basketball team. He was a real jock and a real, aggressive kind of player. Now, you know, he doesn't look like a jock or anything, but he's very, very driven guy.
And the reputation is aggressive. Brian, what was the state and reputation of MF Global when Corzine became its CEO in 2010? Wasn't it an ailing company?
I think it was pretty much MF who. I'd never heard of it. I don't know anybody who had heard of it that didn't follow Wall Street closely. And I think to those of us who had some familiarity with Corzine at that point, I was stunned. It was pretty clear that he was going to be a very big fish in a small pond, and the only thing that one could figure out at that point is that he saw a little value in going back to a high-profile job that would essentially replicate things he'd done before. He wanted to build something anew.
Did he think he could turn it around?
Oh, goodness, yeah. I don't think he went there to make happen what ultimately happened.
And one of the MF Global colleagues said that Corzine is the most competitive person in the world. So he was assuming that he was really going to be able to do this. Bethany, his former Goldman colleagues, Robert Rubin and Hank Paulson, had moved on to political appointments in the Treasury Department. Hasn't it been suggested that Corzine saw MF Global as a stepping stone to Washington?
There's some sense that he was aiming toward Washington, yes. Some people thought that his becoming the governor of New Jersey was actually a way that he could burnish his credentials in order to become president. And at MF Global, there's this remarkable moment, and it comes not so long before the company ends up filing for bankruptcy, in which MF Global sells bonds, and they promise investors that if Corzine leaves to become Treasury Secretary, they'll increase the interest rate that they're paying investors by 1%. And that shows two things. One, I think it points to Corzine's ambitions, but two, it points to how important everyone thought Corzine was to MF Global.
Well, what was Corzine's relationship with Rubin and Paulson? Wasn't he ousted from Goldman by Paulson?
He was. Paulson was a leading part of the cabal that led to Corzine's ouster, and the two men are reportedly not close at all. In fact, there's a fair amount of animosity there. But that doesn't, you know, Corzine is indeed extremely competitive, and as somebody said to us in the story, 99% of people would look at his resume, you know, serving as the managing partner of Goldman Sachs, serving as the governor of New Jersey, and say, wow, let me retire and coast on this. And John looked at it and said, well, it's not as good as my peers have done. And there's no question he was competitive.
Bill, what led to his being ousted from Goldman Sachs in 1999?
Well, I think the first thing is that Hank Paulson, who we were just talking about, who would succeed Corzine as the senior partner of Goldman Sachs.
They had been paired together,
yes, at the top, but Corzine making it very clear to Paulson that he was the senior partner. He even referred to himself as the CEO of Goldman Sachs, which made no sense because it was a private partnership, and that always rankled against Hank. And, you know, Hank was a banker, and Corzine was a trader. It wasn't the old, you know, typical Wall Street bankers versus traders things. I just think they actually did not like each other and get along very well. And as a result of that, I think there was always tension there. And then Corzine started to do some things that really got under the skin of Paulson, which was started encouraging Paulson and having his own conversations with other CEOs on Wall Street talking about merging Goldman Sachs with those firms. And the last straw was when he had these sort of secret negotiations with Mellon Bank, the CEO of Mellon Bank, and through Chris Flowers, a colleague of Paulson's and Corzine's, he heard about these negotiations, confronted Corzine. Corzine minimized them, but they had actually gotten very far along, and that was the final straw.
And would that have led to a stronger company?
You know, ironically, you know, now given the new landscape that Goldman has to play in, I've actually believed that a merger with Mellon Bank would actually be a very good idea for Goldman at this point.
Brian, MF Global filed for bankruptcy in October. Even though it was considered rather small, it's the biggest Wall Street bankruptcy since Lehman Brothers and the eighth largest in corporate history. But then there's that $2 billion of client money that's missing. What was his explanation for that when he testified before Congress about it?
As I recall, it was, I don't know. It was along the lines of, there's a lot of money missing and I don't have a clue.
Well, that's a lot of money to not know about. What portion would it have been of the amount of money that MF Global was working with?
I can't tell you off the top of my head, Leonard, but I will say that as a journalist, you would expect me to take the kind of conspiratorial, he obviously knows what happened point of view, and I haven't seen any evidence that he has. And I've had a nodding familiarity with him as a neighbor, actually, and an acquaintance for years. And I came to believe during the course of this reporting what I think a lot of people who know Corzine believe, and that is, and call me naive, I just don't believe doing something illegal is in the man's DNA.
But still, you have to wonder what kind of a CEO he was if so much money disappears, whether he was involved in it. No one seems to have suggested that he took the money or that he was aware of anyone else taking it. Still, hasn't this damaged his reputation irreparably?
Oh, yes. I think that I think most of us would be stunned if he returned to the securities business. At this point, at this age, married to a very wealthy woman and still having a good deal of money of his own, I think my opinion is he rides into a nice sunset.
Which is what he should have done with it before going to MF Global, frankly.
Yes, clearly.
My guests are William D. Cohn, Brian Burrow, and Bethany McLean, who have all contributed to an article called John Corzine's Riskiest Business. It's in the February issue of Vanity Fair. Bethany, as we mentioned, Corzine did not come from a wealthy family, but he is extremely wealthy and spent record amounts on his political campaigns in New Jersey. Had he, when he was growing up, had he always wanted to work on Wall Street?
I think that's hard to say, and that's probably a better question for Bill than it is for me, given that Bill's investigated Corzine's background more thoroughly. At least from what I know, it was almost more accidental, the way a hardworking kid from a small town, a lot of hardworking kids from small towns found their way into Wall Street. Hank Paulson was exactly the same, a Midwestern farm boy who made his way into a lucrative Wall Street firm, but less from starting out with a blinding ambition than sort of step by step advancing. But Bill, if you have something to add to that, you should jump in.
Well, I would only amplify that yes, I mean, it was sort of by serendipity as much as anything else. He wanted to be a success. He had tried to get a job in St. Louis, couldn't, when they lived there, and then he moved to Chicago to get a job. His family stayed in Taylorville, Illinois. I mean, so he was looking for work, and then he started enrolling in the University of Chicago at night, and this led to sort of an opportunity working in with a banker, a local banker, in the bond business, and one thing led to another, and he got lucky and got an interview with Goldman.
And was Goldman as successful then as it is now?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
It was already the giant squid?
Well, look, it's tough to write a book about Goldman in the wake of the giant squid metaphor, but the truth is that Goldman, as Bethany knows well, has always been an incredibly profitable firm. Not continuously, but in 1993 they had their most successful year ever, $2.7 billion in profits, and then the next year they almost went out of business, so it's a tough business.
Although when they made that $2.7 billion, Corzine took home $25 million. That's a lot of money then. Now,
huge,
I guess,
amount
it's
of money then.
A normal amount for somebody in that
position. Still
a
lot of money now, believe it or not.
So when did he first become interested in politics, Bethany?
I think that started after he was ousted from Goldman Sachs, and it took a lot of his friends by surprise because he was not the sort of guy to whom glad handing came easily. And there's some great anecdotes in the story about his people trying to teach him to be a little bit smoother with people. He had a reputation for actually being able to be quite charismatic one on one, but the sort of group nature glad handing of politics didn't come naturally to him. But it seemed an avenue in which he could prove something and reclaim some honor that he felt he'd lost.
And Brian, were his friends surprised when he went into politics?
Oh, I think everyone was. It was a startling a move in its way when it happened in 1999, as the move to MF Global was 10 years later. John Corzine is the absolute antithesis of a glad-handing politician. I think while most people would describe him as adept in small groups, he is a famously, infamously hopeless public speaker. I think he's gotten better over the years. But what startled everyone is this was a man who essentially lost his identity when he was ejected from Goldman. At age 51, he had no clue what he was going to do, nor did anyone else. I think it was naturally assumed he would move to another firm. Then suddenly, a New Jersey senator, Frank Lautenberg, decided not to run to election. And the next thing everyone knows is John is running around to friends saying, "What would you think if I ran for the Senate?" And I talked to one of his neighbors and longtime friends who said, when John mentioned that to me over coffee, I literally spit my coffee up all over his hands.
And that he didn't love being a senator.
No, that was, I think disastrous is too strong a word, but it was not the job that Corzine hoped. Clearly, Corzine believed that he was joining the most exclusive club in the world, and what he learned was it's not much fun being number 100 in that club. After barely 3 or 4 years in the Senate, he had already begun to look around, and that's when he set his sights on running for governor of New Jersey. But what's important to remember that few people might know is that it's very clear that he did that. He ran for governor of New Jersey with an eye toward a governorship, especially a strong one like New Jersey, being really the best path that he could follow if he wanted to run for president.
So he was always aiming to be CEO.
Oh, yes, without a doubt.
And he just lucked out when Jim McGreevy was forced to resign as the governor of New Jersey. We'll continue our conversation with Brian Burrow, William D. Cohn, and Bethany McLean, talking about John Corzine, their article that they all contributed to in the February issue of Vanity Fair is called John Corzine's Riskiest Business. Stay with us. We are back with Bethany McLean, William D. Cohn, and Brian Burrow, the three contributors to a complex article, because we're talking about a complex man here. It's called John Corzine's Riskiest Business, and it is in the February issue of Vanity Fair. Each of you took a different aspect of John Corzine's personality and career to focus on?
True.
What did you do, William?
I did the Goldman era.
And I did politics and social and private life.
And I assume, Bethany, you focused on MF Global?
That's correct.
So when I come back to you, we'll talk a bit more about MF Global. But right now we're talking about politics, and I guess that's you, Brian. He spent $62 million on his campaign for U.S. Senator, $43 million on his gubernatorial campaign. Critics said that he bought those offices. How did he respond?
Well, he had a difficult time denying it, wouldn't he? I think what Corzine found is that it was a lot easier to, in essence, buy an office than it was to run a state. He found that he was able to, through generous donations, buy the loyalty of a lot of legislators and party bosses. But he was really never able to buy the love of the people of New Jersey. I think that the sense of the public there was always that there was a good deal of respect. I don't think anyone doubted the earnestness of Corzine and the young group of Wall Streeters that he brought in to fix a badly broken state. But he was never really able to rally support.
Well, New Jersey was deeply in debt when he took office. And as you say, he reached out to a lot of his Wall Street colleagues for help. Wouldn't people, the regulars in New Jersey, get a little upset that he was going outside regular channels, excluding them?
You obviously don't live in New Jersey, Leonard. New Jersey finances are so broken, I think people would have welcomed space aliens into Trenton if they thought that they could somehow reduce our property taxes.
And then came the first real shocker. He was riding in the front seat of a car, not wearing a seatbelt, when there was an accident on the Garden State Parkway. He was badly injured. Some have called his recovery miraculous. Was that a turning point for him? Wasn't he already dealing with another kind of personal scandal, a girlfriend?
The girlfriend was there, but this was a life-changing event. I think few appreciate how close he came to death. He tells the story about being in the ambulance and he couldn't move, and he thought he was paralyzed and he panicked. In fact, he was just strapped down. And then the humorous thing that he sometimes joked about with friends is the next thing he felt was his body rising, and he felt he must be going to heaven. And in fact, he was just going up in the medevac, and one of his friends I talked to said, "John, you must know that if you must have known you weren't dying because you would have been going the other way."
Do you think that these were some of the reasons that he lost to Chris Christie in 2009?
I don't think you can draw a direct line between the accident and the loss, but clearly, given an ambitious legislative agenda that was underway during a budgetary time at the moment of that accident, the least you can say is that he lost a good deal of momentum and probably his best chance at lasting change in New Jersey finances.
Bethany, so he went to MF Global, and did he say that he wanted to make changes there? Was he going to try to make it more like Goldman Sachs?
Not only did he want to make changes, he had to make changes. I think few people appreciate the depth of the trouble that MF Global's business was in. The falling interest rates in the wake of the crisis had really wreaked havoc on MF Global's ability to make a profit. The company had lost money for the years before Corzine got there, and they were facing a downgrade by the credit rating agencies, which would effectively have put them out of business. So Corzine had two choices. He could have really just cut the business and pared it, or he could have tried to build it into something else. And as someone I talked to said to me, Corzine came to build. And so he took the latter course, and he began radically changing MF Global.
But this is a company that needed to make money fast, didn't it?
It definitely needed to make money fast. The credit rating agencies, who, as you know, hold a great deal of probably unwarranted power in our economy, were threatening to downgrade MF Global unless it could produce a certain level of – unless it could show that it could produce a certain level of profits.
To give us a little background on how companies like MF Global work, Bill, can you explain some of the rules that govern investment firms like the Commodities and Exchange Act? Am I asking the wrong person here?
You may have to ask Gary Gensler to make a brief, quick appearance. I mean, look, these companies basically. This is the important, I think, takeaway. Leonard, and I'm going to try to cleverly evade answering your question directly, and that is that these companies, securities firms, are really in the business of borrowing on a short-term basis and then using that capital and lending it outside on a longer-term basis and making a profit on the spread. That's the way banks work, and that's what MF Global was doing. It was taking, you know, whether it's by the CFTC allowed this, them to use part of their customers' money and make investments. They took in many that they raised, as Bethany was talking about, in the public sphere, and they borrowed money on a short-term basis and turned it around and made this long-term bet on European sovereign debt, which, once the market found out about it, went berserk.
And then, of course, the Eurozone went down the tubes. That couldn't have made things any easier. But what about changes in regulations that have happened more recently, changes that make it easier for financial firms to make riskier investments, Bethany?
Well, there were a couple of changes that took place, and in fairness, the changes themselves took place before Corzine's tenure at MF Global, and one of those changes allowed a firm to invest client money not just in super safe assets like U.S. Treasuries, but in assets everyone thought were safe until very recently, like European sovereign debt. And another change allowed this complicated lending mechanism between different parts of a firm like MF Global using customer funds. So in essence, the rules surrounding what you could do with customer funds went from being pretty strict to being a little bit looser. And there was some efforts on the part of Gary Gensler actually to roll back these changes and make the rules very tight again. And Corzine and his people at MF Global pushed back very aggressively against tightening these rules.
So he came in at a time when the Eurozone crisis hit?
Had come in at before the Eurozone crisis was really hitting, but by the time he was investing in European sovereign debt, the Eurozone crisis was starting to hit, yes. And that's precisely why he invested in European sovereign debt. The perception of risk had gone up, and so it paid a little bit more. You could earn a little bit more money by buying European sovereign debt than you could by buying U.S. Treasuries.
John Corzine continues to be a controversial figure, and we're exploring the many reasons he is with Bethany McLean, Brian Barrow, and William D. Cohen, the three contributors to an article called John Corzine's Riskiest Business, in the February issue of Vanity Fair. We have a link to an excerpt from the article on our show page at WNYC.org. The article is so big, I guess we didn't have enough bites to handle the whole thing. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How had the company been betting on sovereign debt? Can you explain how MF Global got itself into so much trouble by making risky investments that didn't show up on the balance sheet?
It's a little bit complicated, but what MF Global did was invest in billions of dollars, a net over $6 billion at the peak of sovereign debt, and they used a complicated form of accounting that enabled them to book the prospective earnings from this trade up front, thereby helping to meet these rating agency demands to show profits. And all the debt and the corresponding assets were removed from their balance sheets. And this form of accounting is legal, and the MF Global's accountant signed off on it. But it's also a form of accounting that people told me would raise a red flag among many accountants and risk managers, that if they saw this taking place, they'd question what the firm was up to. It was that much of a red flag.
Don from New York left this question on our show page. Shouldn't the SEC bring back the net capitalization rule, and did it ever apply to commodities futures broker dealers? And any of you have any thoughts on that? Okay, well,
That's beyond my kin.
Well, MF Global did have a broker-dealer as part of it. It was made up of separate companies under a holding company, and one part of it was a broker-dealer that would have fallen under that rule. Yes. As to what effect that had on the company's collapse, I think it's really hard to say. The problems it's really hard to say whether that's something that would have prevented the problems at MF Global.
Has anybody come up with an explanation for where that $1.2 billion went?
No, that's, I think, the most stunning thing about this story, and to me an incredibly frightening commentary on the state of modern finance, is that we're, what, 2+ months after MF Global's bankruptcy, and most of the $1.2 billion, at least as far as we know publicly, still hasn't been traced. And that, to me, is just, it's just astonishing, and it, you know, casts doubt on this transparent, supposedly automated world that we live in, and shows the very human and scarily human nature of modern finance.
Brian?
People talk so much over the last 4 or 5 years about things being too big to fail and the dangers of hugeness and how big Wall Street banks and investment banks have become. One could argue this is the greatest example of that I have seen come down the pike, and that is, it is now possible for one of these banks, not even the largest one, to misplace $1.2 billion, like your reading glasses, and have no one be able to find it.
Well, when you misplace your cell phone, you can find somebody with another phone and call your number. But at $1.2 billion, a lot of money to misplace. Somebody has it. It has to be somewhere.
Well, I mean, you know, look, my theory at this point is that they probably used it to cover margin calls in that final week when they had these big margin calls. They thought, well, we'll use this customer cash or whatever because we're allowed to do that by the CFTC. We'll replace it on Monday when we get there, and they didn't get to Monday.
So it was almost like a Bernie Madoff kind of situation, paying off.
Well, it did have that sort of like Ponzi-esque aspect to it, but only for a week or so.
And I think what you'll find, my gut tells me, at the end of the day, is not illegal intent, but people scrambling around, probably mid-level people scrambling around, moving $1 billion overnight, as happens every day on Wall Street. And unfortunately, when they did it, that was the last night.
I wish they would move it into my account. Can customers get any of their money back from MF Global?
I think they already have started getting a bunch of their money back. I mean, it's now with the trustee in the bankruptcy and the Louis Free, who's the FBI, former FBI director, who's investigating it all. I think they've started to get some of the money back, but of course they're still waiting for this last $1.2 billion, which is nothing to sneeze at.
And who's online first, the big creditors like J.P. Morgan?
Well, again, these are decisions made by the bankruptcy judge and with the trustees' agreement, but I think the customers are probably first in line, those who didn't even know their money was being used this way and thought that they had. I've talked to a number of customers who found themselves thinking they just had futures or buying corn futures or whatever it is, found that they can't get their money back. Their screens went blank when this thing filed, and so they're first in line, I suspect.
You mentioned earlier that when the Commodities and Futures Trading Commission attempted to change regulations on investing in sovereign debt over the summer, Corzine lobbied against it.
Big time. And his general counsel lobbied against it, who has also worked at Goldman with Corzine once upon a time. Yes, they were very aggressive about using the, and of course Gary Gensler, the head of the CFTC, who is a wonderful guy actually, but you know, did work at Goldman for Corzine, and Corzine came and lobbied him heavily, and he backed down on having this vote.
I don't know if any of you can speak to this, but a listener left this comment on our show page. The recent New Jersey Turnpike and Garden State Parkway toll increases intended to finance the ARC Tunnel project that was canned by Christie took effect this past January 1st. The governor and his surrogates are tagging the increase on Corzine. Is this true, or is it just game playing? The article does mention one of his failed plans for the parkway and the turnpike.
Look, this is a 12,000-word article. I think we adequately covered the waterfront as far as John Corzine goes. It is possible that we inadequately reported the future, the subtleties of turnpike finance. That I just don't know the answer.
I don't either.
Well, in the end, everybody in politics blames everybody else. But John Corzine still has a lot to answer for. Right now, you're saying he's just going to retire. And
well, at first he has to deal with lawsuits and Congress and investigations. And
will money come out of his pocket to pay for some of this?
It rarely does. I would bet that it won't unless, again, there's some sort of criminal intent that is found, which doesn't seem to be the case at this point.
Still, your article is called John Corzine's Riskiest Business. Who was he risking? What was he risking? It wasn't his own money.
No, in the end, he certainly risked MF Global's future, and that was the future of its employees. Roughly 1,000 of them have already lost their jobs in a very tough time for job prospects, as we all know. And this customer money has gone missing, and it's really hard to overstate the importance of that, because customer money at a firm like MF Global was supposed to be sacrosanct. It was supposed to be safe no matter what happened to the firm. So even though MF Global's bankruptcy is smallish in the scheme of things compared to Lehman and the events we saw in the fall of 2008, this is a huge betrayal for those customers who had their money at MF Global. It's a sign, just another sign, that the financial industry doesn't work the way it's supposed to.
And I would just add that it was a completely voluntary. This did not have to happen. This was not MF Global's business plan. John Corzine came in there determined to remake it with Chris Flowers' help, who had his own private equity firm, who bought a big chunk of MF Global and brought Corzine back. This did not have to happen. This was entirely preventable. This is human error to the max.
And if I might add, I think the greatest irony here is this was a man who, when he left Goldman, spent 10 years through the Senate, through the governor's mansion, and now into MF Global, essentially at the core of his being, trying to reclaim his reputation. And I think that what he never understood and probably couldn't have understood in this final last bet at MF Global is that he was not only betting the firm's money and the firm's reputation, but he bet his own reputation, and he lost, and now he has very little of it left.
My great thanks to Brian Burrow, William D. Cohen, and Bethany McLean, the three contributors to a huge article in the February issue of Vanity Fair called John Corzine's Riskiest Business. Also, congratulations, Bill, your latest book, Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, has just been released today by Anchor Books in a paperback edition.
Thank you, Leonard.
And it's been a great pleasure having the three of you on our show today.
Thank you.
I'm not sure John Corzine was happy to hear this segment. We'll be right back.